Podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion, but more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle, so send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, I am joined by three of my retina colleagues to discuss a recent article that went viral on the internet and social media. This is a little atypical from our normal journal clubs, which we have recorded and on reserve for the following weeks, or interviews. But given the relevance of this article and how many people are discussing it, we decided to discuss it here on this podcast call. Remember that a list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. And remember that you can claim CME credits for this episode and many other episodes on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply navigate to the link in the episode description, and that will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to log in and get your credits. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by three of our retina colleagues from across the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Nika Bagheri from California Retina Consultants in Santa Barbara, California. Nika, welcome on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Next, Dr. M. Ali Khan from Wills Eye Hospital in Mid-Atlantic Retina in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay, for having me.
And last but not least, Dr. Priya Sharma from Retina Group of Washington in Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland. Priya, putting in the time, she's been on a lot recently. Priya, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay. It's good to talk again.
I always get nervous when I have to give alphabetical orders for more than two people. I always worried I'm going to mess it up, which would be something I'd be judged for, but we got through that. Okay, so we are going to discuss this article written on KevinMD.com. KevinMD, just for background, is essentially a social media page where physicians write articles. And this article went viral on social media, Twitter, Facebook, at least what I saw. I'm sure it went viral on other media that I just don't consume. And the title of this article is Keep Insulting Doctors and Good Luck Finding a Physician in 10 Years. This is written by Karen Sibbert on January 17th, 2020. A little different than our journal articles. This is not a peer-reviewed article. This is actually a lay media article inspired by two other lay media articles and kind of a response to those. And Karen Sibbert is Dr. Karen Sibbert is an anesthesiologist who writes a blog online and publishes this on KevinMD. So Priya, do you want to give us just a little background on what she was writing in response to and what she wrote about in this article?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. So Karen Sibbert, Dr. Sibbert is actually an anesthesiologist at UCLA, and she is responding to two articles that were published in the Washington Post a few days ago. One is by Cynthia Weber Cassio, and the other is by Heather Long. She's an economics correspondent for the Washington Post, basically summarizing some economics that were discussed in an article. Basically, just to give a brief background on the two articles that Dr. Sibbert is responding to. So the first is an article by Cynthia Weber Cassio, and she talks about her experience from when she needed an emergent appendectomy. She went to a local hospital. She has insurance coverage. Went to this hospital that was in network, was told she needed an emergent appendectomy, and then in the preoperative area met her surgeon at which time her surgeon told her that he was out of her network and that she would have to pay out of pocket for her appendectomy. And he quoted her a bill of around $15,000. Ms. Cassio at that time felt she really had no choice. She needed emergent surgery, and she was told that the risks of not doing anything would be sepsis and death. So she went ahead and had the surgery. The surgery went great. It lasted 35 minutes. She had no complications. And then eventually she received her surgeon's bill, which ended up being $17,000. And she talks about her struggles with getting this bill repealed, basically going to her insurance company and asking them why they wouldn't cover it, even though the hospital was in network. She even appeals to the Maryland Insurance Administration. She even wrote to the president of the hospital, and it really went all the way up to the attorney general, at which time there was a mutually agreed upon amount of $3,000 that she paid for. But she talks about her outrage at having this surprise medical bill. And she concludes at the end that she feels that doctors and hospitals are squeezed. And there's no clear conclusion as to who is causing the surprise medical bills, but there is a general sense that this is the doctor who's doing it. The second article is an economics article by a correspondent of the Washington Post, and she's summarizing two economists from Princeton who spoke about the healthcare system. And basically, they summarize that the healthcare system is the most expensive in the world. It costs $1 trillion more per year than the next most expensive system, which is Switzerland. But the quality of care and the outcomes are worse than Europe. The healthcare in this country is thought to have worse outcomes than in Europe. And so they conclude that we have the most expensive healthcare, but it delivers the worst health of any rich country. And then they go in further to be very critical of U.S. doctors, pointing out that 16% of people in the top 1% of income earners are physicians, and that even though we have half as many physicians per head as European countries, they get paid two times as much on average. And at one point, they quote that one of the economists said, "Physicians are a giant rent-seeking conspiracy that's taking money away from the rest of us, and yet everybody loves physicians. You can't touch them." Both of these articles are very strongly worded against physicians, but obviously stem from real problems in our healthcare system, you know, being high cost and also surprise medical bills. They're both real problems, but these articles were both written to be very critical of physicians. And so then there was a response then written by Dr. Siebert, who's an anesthesiologist at UCLA, and she basically is outraged by how critical they are of physicians. And her biggest gripe is that the people that are writing these articles are criticizing, but they have no idea what it's like to do a physician's work. They have no idea the stress. And they also don't understand that many of the regulations that are put on for us are not voluntary, but they're by insurance companies or government or things that are out of our control. And then she goes on to describe, you know, the stresses that different physicians go through with different surgical situations, the high risks that we put ourselves in, and then goes to point out that the highest income earners in medicine are actually the CEOs of insurance companies. And her summary at the end is basically that physicians are becoming increasingly disenchanted with medicine, that all of these regulations are making physicians regret that they've been here, that decreased insurance reimbursement and all of the political and logistical problems are basically creating a shortage of physicians, and that inspired the title of her paper, which is "Keep Insulting Doctors and Good Luck Finding a Physician in 10 Years."
That was an amazing summary of three articles all in one, and I've got a lot of thoughts. I know Dr. Bregari has a lot of thoughts, but I know Ali is raring to go. And, you know, the only time I've thought that you can't touch a physician is when Ali is doing his best MC Hammer impression. And I'll get to that in a second, you know, the idea that you can't touch them. But Ali, you read this. You read this article. Maybe you had seen it before I'd sent it to you. Maybe you hadn't. What's your initial reaction?
Yeah, so I had seen it passed around on social media. Like you said, it kind of went viral after it was written. And so I read it. And, you know, I think the first half of the article talking about how, you know, physicians are stressed out a lot, I think is like a common refrain in kind of viral articles in the medical community about how doctors are feeling, you know, burnout or disenchanted with the physician. But I didn't necessarily think that was like a great response to the two articles posted in Washington Post. I think there's a lot of people who have stressful jobs. So just saying that our jobs are stressful and that's why we, you know, get X, Y, or Z payment or something is probably not the bulk of the argument. I think the second half of her article where she's talking about how, you know, there's issues with negotiating with insurance companies. I think most physicians would say that they also agree that surprise medical billing is not a good thing. But to say that it's the doctor's fault, and in the words of the Washington Post article, you know, comparing a doctor to a mugger or a thief is, I think, a little bit extreme. And I think that's the kind of when she's talking about how this is just like hurling insults at a physician. And yeah, in the setting of fewer physician, fewer people entering the physician workforce, you know, she's saying like, look, we're not going to have as many doctors and you keep insulting us. So good luck. And I think that's, you know, kind of a gut reaction that many physicians might feel towards, you know, people criticizing the profession as a whole. You know, the other article from The Economist, where they said that, you know, physicians are a rent-seeking conspiracy, which I also think it seems to be like unnecessarily harshly worded. I don't really
get published in The Washington Post, though.
Right. I know. If it is a clickbait thing, then cool. But I think then having a response from a physician saying, look, this is garbage. Don't call me a mugger. Don't call me a rent-speaking conspiracy when I did this many of years of training, I have this much debt, and I get, you know, hassled by insurance companies. I think it speaks to the general things that physicians in the country, especially younger physicians, are kind of getting sick of, and where that quote-unquote physician burnout feeling is coming from. So I think it's kind of a, you know, a blog post, you know, encapsulating those general feelings, which is why it went viral, because a lot of people can relate to it to some degree. They might not know exactly why. They might not have read the Washington Post article, but for whatever reason, you're like, yeah, I'm with that anesthesiologist on
this. Well, and you kind of did a nice job of separating into the two issues here, right? First, the issue of burnout, which we can address further in this podcast, and it's been addressed before. But second, the issue of the economics of the situation, what happened to this former correspondent who wrote this article, and what these economists are describing. Let's focus a little bit on that insurance side of it, Nika. So, you know, I can see from the patient perspective how, you know, this patient, the former correspondent at CBS, was kind of shocked by the situation. If you haven't been in Ms. Casco, if you haven't been in that sort of situation, maybe, and you don't have the knowledge of the situation, it's very, very surprising. Unfortunately, in medicine, Ali reference, we do see cases of this. You know, she kind of ends her story by saying, well, what would have happened if I had told the surgeon if his fee was too high? I think it gets complicated because this was an emergency surgery. They probably need to proceed anyway, ethically, with this, since she was at risk of going septic. Insurance issues are a constant sort of frustration. What is your perspective, reading her patient perspective, on the things that kind of would help her understand the situation?
Well, first, I would commend Dr. Siebert. You know, I'm grateful that she took it upon herself to give a response from the medical standpoint. I think that in medicine, we have a very strong culture of not complaining and being apolitical, which is admirable in many ways because we're there for patient care. But then there's this lack of understanding and misinformation in the general population, and that just gets propagated while doctors get vilified for these scenarios. And it is really a multifaceted, really complex issue. In terms of the insurance aspect, that's a very real thing where, you know, reality and what we deal with our training is very different. And the insurance companies dictate what contracts they give out. They dictate what type of reimbursement they give out. And I think it's very hard for patients because patients don't understand what's going on and they don't know until they have a problem that their insurance does not cover what they need or adequately cover it. And many of them think they have good insurance, they're paying, you know, monthly premiums. And so when they get to that situation, their ire is taken out on the doctor who is actually just there to provide the care. And often the doctor does not get, reimbursed depending on, or well, you know, well reimbursed for many patients with different types of insurance and depending on the setting, but they still are providing care. So there is a loss in the daily grind that patients don't realize that, you know, we're actually not getting reimbursed for or properly reimbursed for many cases. In terms of the disconnect and this concept of physicians burnout, and she alluded to people taking their own lives because of medical debt, which is a real problem. But at the same time, physician suicide is also very high. There was a medical economics article last year that cited that suicide rate among doctors is the highest of any profession, and a doctor dies by suicide once every day in the United States. And there's a lot of reasons and problems with the way medicine has changed over time. But, you know, there was a lot of commentary on this. There's another video that I think went viral or so by Dr. Z saying that it's not called burnout, it's a moral injury, essentially stating that burnout is sort of like a form of victim shaming where we're not strong enough, whereas moral injury is the fact that we are facing, as a medical field, you know, conflicting things that we can't reconcile on the front line, where we want to take care of the patient, but then we're constrained by the system that we work within.
Those are great points. And that kind of leads into my impressions, and I'll let Bria comment, or Ali comment again. When I read that quote from Deaton, who is a Nobel Prize winner in economics, what I see is someone who sees the forest in many ways, but doesn't understand the forest because he doesn't see the tree. And it's the opposite problem. He's looking at the stats and he looks at these numbers and he pulls up these numbers and said, obviously this is the problem, but doesn't quite understand. He understands our health system is broken. I think many of us do, even within the profession, without the profession, without outside the profession. If you look at the debates in the Democratic or on the Republican side in the last few years, regardless of your affiliation, people agree the healthcare system could be better and should be better. But I think the big thing they're missing is you can't compare, in many ways, comparing the situation of U.S. medical doctors to the situation of doctors in Europe, for example. These are apples and oranges arguments, right? That the length of training is different between those countries. The type of residency and fellowship training is different in terms of the amount of doing versus watching an apprenticeship. The system in terms of how patients get care and the speed at which they get care varies country to country in terms of the setup. And malpractice, which is a serious issue in the United States for physicians and maybe is appropriate in the cases where patients need reparations for liability, but is a huge stressor overhanging the medical system and overhanging doctors psychologically, is not as big an issue in some of these countries. And these all contribute to what Nico was talking about, this moral injury, this burnout. Everything is a scale, and there's things that make you want to be a doctor, and there's things that make you not want to be a doctor, just like any profession. And now we're starting to get other things that are tipping the scales, things like increased administrative burden, increased red tape, insurance issues for your patients, patients being critical of you in reviews, articles like this one, and reading about the impressions patients have. I mean, none of us want to deal with unhappy patients. We want our patients to get good care and be happy. So, Ali, I'll let you comment first. I mean, when you read that from Deaton, I mean, these are not uneducated people, but there is got to be a degree of lack of understanding about how the healthcare system is flawed in the U.S. versus other places.
Yeah, I think there's probably a big misunderstanding there. I mean, to compare the United States with its population and racial and ethnic diversity, economic diversity to Switzerland or Scandinavian countries, just simply garbage comparison. So, you know, it's a completely different country, different types of people. The politics of the country, the history of the countries are so different, you cannot compare them. So I think, you know, that alone, it gives us a measure that, yes, our healthcare system is costing more money and we're having, you know, worse outcomes, particularly in related to life expectancy, because their focus as economists are on the opioid crisis and how that's led to U.S. life expectancy going down. But I don't think that's just, you know, wow, you say, wow, your country is more expensive than this country, but no real explanation as to how to fix it. And the article does mention some of their suggestions as what to do to fix it. They mentioned that everyone needs to be in a health system, meaning, you know, everyone should have some sort of insurance to so everyone's in the safety net and paying into it. And there should be cost controls, including price caps on drugs and government decisions not to cover some procedures. So great. I think everyone probably agrees that those are promising reforms. But again, why that's tied into an article where they're calling physicians rent-seeking conspiracies, I don't get it. I think most physicians would probably agree the insurance company and the pharmaceutical industry is likely where a lot of our higher costs are going towards. And the physicians are sort of whole feeling that we're unduly blamed for that because we're easy targets. When you go up against a big company like Merck or some, you know, Fortune 500 company, you can't touch them. And hey, we're a private company. We have shareholders we need to address, and you know, that's considered okay. But a physician, you're an individual, so I think you're an easy target. So they mention things that are good reform, but I think those are obvious. It doesn't necessarily make sense with the rest of the comments in their article that are more inflammatory.
Well, it's easier to have a villain with a face. And I think this is the problem when the insurance companies negotiate the patient. It's the patient has a face to the doctor, but they don't have a face to the administrator, the bureaucrat, someone behind the scenes who's pulling the strings to make sure the insurance company doesn't cover something that they don't want to cover. I mean, the fundamental issue here is that insurance companies are for-profit companies, similar to a place that sells parts or to a grocery store or to someone selling you car insurance or a car. I mean, they want to make a profit. And so if you work for an insurance company, you're doing your job and you're doing a good job, you want to find ways to maximize profits and minimize costs. However, the most efficient ways to do that aren't necessarily quote unquote benevolent or ethical in situations where patients need care, right? And so, I mean, Priya, one thing I've thought about, and maybe others have thought about this, is in medicine, we have kind of this Hippocratic oath. We have kind of a culture of beneficence and non-maleficence. And, you know, in finance, this is not true for obviously for everyone in finance, but there's this idea of fiduciary, doing things that are the best interest of your client. And in law, there's this belief that you have to do what's best in the interest of your client and the law. Insurance companies have no sort of mandate like that. And that creates a fundamental issue. Do you, obviously, maybe it's not realistic, but do you think insurance companies should be? I mean, should there be some sort of mandate saying, you know, there are certain things you cannot do just to maximize profits? For example, I mean, hiring, for example, when they do peer-to-peer consultations, they're essentially just creating red tape so that patients can't get approved for a procedure until the doctor speaks to someone on the other end who is not necessarily a specialist in their field.
I mean, that would be amazing if there could be legislation passed that ensured that insurance companies couldn't basically create these hoops. I mean, I would be really upset if I were this patient too and $17,000 bill. And I think the fact that that's even happening, that surprise medical billing is happening, is ridiculous. But I think the inherent problem here is that it's the insurance company that is largely creating these issues. And if there could be some way that, we hear these stories on the news about a patient that needed a life-saving procedure and got denied 16, 17 times until somehow they contacted the right person, they went to the media, and then it got approved. You know, why do patients have to go through that? Why are there these barriers to care for patients to get the appropriate care that they need? I have no idea. And I completely agree. If we can pass some legislation that would end this, that would be great. And make insurance companies, you know, if not force them to do it, make them liable for whatever adverse event happens. You know, the surgeon can get sued, and the hospital can get sued, but why not the insurance company? And so, if they're the person that's holding up care, I feel like at least at the very least, that could be something that could be helpful.
And Nika, one thing that Ali referenced was why is this article written this way? And the problem with articles like this, we already have situations where, unfortunately, most doctors try to do the right thing, but sometimes doctors don't do the right thing, and that's publicized. But articles like this further kind of erode trust between patients and society and physicians. And trust is a real important part of what we do. Trust not only that your doctor has your best interest in heart, but trust that your doctor isn't simply doing something for financial gain, that your doctor simply isn't, as they so drastically put, that doctors are simply, what do they call them? What was that thing phrase you used, Ali? The rent, it's a rent seeking conspiracy. I mean, this is the Washington Post, right? This is, people are reading this, and people tend to believe what they read. What is the impact of articles like this? And again, Dr. Sabia, you have to compliment her, because one of the things she's doing is she's kind of fighting that. How we're portrayed plays a huge role in how patients trust us.
Right. I think it's tough, and it ties into the aspect of, like, we have the suicide rate among physicians and the evolving healthcare field. When you put 10 or 15 years of your life, your 20s, your sleep, your family, you know, things like that on hold and sacrifice it. And then you go into a field and you have this idealistic view that you're going to be able to take care of patients. And that inherently conflicts with the system that you're working with in the real world. Then I think that harms patients as well as physicians to some extent. But I did want to make one point just in terms of not being comparable to other countries, other developed countries. And I agree with that. The U.S. is not comparable. But I did also want to point out that doctors that are in these other developed countries like Canada or Europe and in Germany, the doctors have actually protested their working conditions. And that is very atypical, you know, for German culture. It's a big deal for them to do that, but they've protested because they're not happy with their long working hours and their low pay, and they want to come to the United States. So there needs to be something sustainable where, you know, for everybody involved, and these other systems that get compared to the U.S. and while the U.S. is criticized and we do have a broken system, they aren't perfect either. And, you know, at least the doctors in Germany, they were asking for very reasonable things, to have, you know, 2 weekends free per month and to have some predictability in their roster schedule. You know, so it's not something that's outlandish where they're asking for a $5 million paycheck. And I think that is something that we forget sometimes when we're comparing the pros of their, you know, setup to the cons of the United States kind of model. And then for the U.S., the real world right now is very different than when we all chose to go into medicine. You know, we, at least as a child for me, there were solo private practice doctors that were in the community and, you know, were inspiring to me. And right now, you know, for the last year, the AMA was just publishing out for the first time in the United States, there's more employed physicians than self-employed physicians, and that this continues to progress as more doctors are part of hospital systems or venture capitalist groups, and that they don't have this autonomy, and that this ties into a reduction in many cases in patient care as well as physician happiness. And I'll say the legislation as well for you know, being nonprofit. They talk about, you know, many hospitals are nonprofit, but they're actually creating a profit. They're just putting it back into, you know, the hospital system. So the communities that they exist in aren't able to get a taxable benefit from them the way they would from a solo practitioner that's paying taxes, and it goes back into the community. Instead, it could go, you know, to the salary or to, you know, other things.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, nonprofit is one of those really misleading terms. Just because you're a nonprofit does not mean that either you're benevolent or your costs are going to be low. Or that the people working for a nonprofit are not making high salaries.
I read that because my own family friend was asking, like, oh, if they make a nonprofit, would that fix it? And, you know, there's a complete lack of understanding in terms of how the medical nonprofit system works. And with the additional administrative burden that you were talking about before with EMR, you know, this promise of having this universal healthcare system, but none of these systems actually talk to each other. And it just creates more regulations and rules. It makes it very hard for physicians to have autonomy or to be solo.
Great points. Ali and Priya and Anika, I mean, the last thing that really stands out to me, Priya, you referenced this when you were summarizing the Cascio article. I mean, I feel like it sometimes as a physician community, we can say in general or even a specific physician, you can sometimes become too good. Like, I feel like a little bit of the outrage here was this, oh, this was just a simple 35-minute appendectomy. And Dr. Siebert kind of referenced this. It's like, you know, it went 35 minutes, so how did it cost so much? And if it spent 2 hours, it would have cost more. And, you know, ophthalmology has seen this, where cataract surgery used to be reimbursed a lot more. And as it's gotten more efficient, it's gotten cut. And I wonder sometimes that it's like the opposite, right? You would think in any other field, be like, oh, you got this done so quickly, you know, I have no problem paying you X amount. But it's weird, and sometimes in medicine, people will almost have a lowered appreciation for something if you don't spend as long doing it. And it's counterintuitive when every study, regardless of surgical field, says the shorter procedure, the better outcomes. And every, you know, hospitalization stays, for example, are better if they're shorter, not when they're longer. Patients have better outcomes. Ali, I mean, any comments? That was the other thing that really stood out that Dr. Siebert pointed out, was that's also something culturally that we got to kind of turn on its head, because that actually sounds like the appendectomy was very smooth and uncomplicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, George Williams says this all the time when he, you know, gives talks at large meetings, that, you know, the number one factor that CMS, you know, determines for, you know, the reimbursement for any given procedure or CPT code is the time it takes to do it. So, you know, the fact that you can do cataract surgery faster or an appendectomy faster just means it gets devalued. So, you know, that's CMS doing that. you know, so, you know, the board that determines what physicians get paid in general for Medicare and otherwise is setting that precedent. And so patients kind of are getting the same impression that if it takes a short, how could it be so expensive? But, you know, it just discounts the fact that maybe doctors and our techniques and our technology is getting better. Does that mean it should be devalued? And it just goes into the argument again that, you know, Nika brought up consolidation, and I think a lot of the reasons why there is an argument for consolidation is to negotiate with payers, right? So it's, in the end, I think the frustration I think a lot of physicians feel is that a lot of the angst or displeasure at the healthcare system is getting unduly placed on individual physicians or the medical field in general, and not pointed towards what I think most physicians feel is the actual problem. Either legislation that does not curb kind of abuses within an insurance system, and also drug costs. So I think as retina specialists, that's what I feel is what affects a lot of the things that I do. But, you know, to put that on individual physicians, especially younger physicians, seems like it's out of left field. So I think that's where a bigger part of the disconnect is as well.
Priya and then Nika, I don't want people to devalue this podcast if it's too short, so we're going to make it longer. Priya, your final thoughts and impressions before we break?
You know, I'm going to talk about a story that my brother told me. So my brother's a urologist in Texas, and he did a prostatectomy in Lubbock, Texas, and got paid, I don't know, let's say $3,000. He did the exact same surgery in Abilene, Texas, and got paid six times as much. And I don't understand why, and this brings back to Ali's point, is that, you know, he's part of a big healthcare system and somehow this has all been worked out behind the scenes, but there's no sense to somehow to how these things are reimbursed. It all just depends on how big your practice is, how much geographical hold you have in that area. And I completely agree with him that some oversight needs to be had to make this just all a little bit more fair. And you know, the other thing that I'll mention is that when we're talking about other countries here, yes, while the cost of care may be better, I think we can all agree that we've had patients who've come from other countries to the United States for care that would happen more expeditiously. You know, I had a patient who flew all the way from Canada just last week for surgery because he said that his surgery there was delayed a month. And so, you know, there are problems with overhauling the medical system, and we have to recognize the problems in other countries and understand whether patients here are going to be willing to accept the downsides that come with overhauling the medical system. And I think everyone will agree that we need to do something, but I think my final words are, as physicians, I would love for my patients to get better access to care. I would love for them to have low-cost care. I think we all did this for good intentions, and the problem with these articles is it doesn't identify who the real problem is, which, you know, in my opinion, and it is a very biased opinion, in my opinion, it's not necessarily a physician.
Nika, your last thoughts?
I agree. I agree with Ali and Priya. These are really multifaceted, complex issues. And even though I'm in healthcare and I live it, you know, I don't have the answer. I do think there's a lot of areas that, even with someone who is knowledgeable about healthcare, there's unforeseen or unintended consequences to certain legislation. And that's what makes it really dangerous is, you know, Ali was talking about CMS, you know, facing it based on time. But if people who don't know what's going on legislate certain reimbursements or rules, then, you know, what you find is that there's a certain level of cherry picking where it's going to be easier to do a straightforward case than all the patients that have complex issues, do not have care, or access to care because no one's going to reimburse for it. So there's just so many downstream effects that could occur. And I think all of those need to be taken into account. I think that physicians should be at the table, you know, and trying to anticipate these issues so that we can work better as a team and, you know, provide the best possible care for our patients.
Thank you guys for your time and for discussing this article. Thank you to Dr. Siebert for writing the article. We really appreciate her getting this out there and speaking for the physician community. And I think the fact that it did go viral speaks to a lot how people, like as Ali said, feel about this article. So thank you guys for your time and for commenting.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for having us.
All right, guys. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's R-E-T-I-N-A podcast.com. You can find all 210, yes, 210 episodes found on our website as they are sorted by category. It's a great archive. If you want to go back, review a topic, rehash something. I go back sometimes and listen to certain surgical techniques like doing a direct perfluorocarbon silicone oil exchange or tips for doing a scleral fixated IOL. Sometimes if I'm doing one after a while, it's nice to rehash on my drive into work or the night before just to make sure everything is running as needed. We got different topics, obviously surgical retina, medical retina, and the financial and career planning mix all available on the website dating back to late 2016. Remember, you can contact us by going to our website, retinapodcast.com, and clicking on the Contact Us button. You can also subscribe there to get emails with each of the episodes as they come out. You can also contact us and find us on Twitter at Retina Podcast or on our Facebook group, Retina Podcast. We are in the Apple Store and Android Store. You can find us there to subscribe and get updates on your phone. And remember, we appreciate positive reviews. So if you have positive reviews about this episode, if you want to share it on social media, we appreciate that. And please let us know episode ideas for the future as we go forward. Many thanks to Drs. Bagheri, Khan and Sharma for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Karen Siebert, who wrote that article again. We really appreciate, as a medical community, her standing up and writing it. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venicasa, who prepared this episode and the accompanying social media. Listeners, goes without saying, thank you for doing what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.